Wow, can we just be reminded today that God still redeems brokenness, including in marriage? I mean, his love and his grace are a powerful force that we can never count out. So thanks so much for joining us today. The idea of marriage in our country today is in need of some corrective measures. There are a lot of myths out there about love and relationships, and the myths often come from Hollywood. I mean, just spend a little time researching the success rate of marriages in Hollywood, and I think you'll soon conclude that you should find a new authority on the subject. Most of the stories in the movies, they go like this. Boy meets girl, or girl meets boy. After a rocky beginning, they finally realize that they were perfect for each other all along. And it's a storybook love affair with a handsome man and a gorgeous woman, that the sex is great and frequent. They have darling little children. They live in a lovely home. They have a substantial income. They're successful in their work. They're physically agile and enjoy sports. There's plenty of money to do all the things that happily married couples do. They experience some hardships along the way, but nasty disagreements are few and far between. And in the end, they live happily ever after. It's a myth that it will all come together like this. And there are other myths, things like you'll find the perfect person, then it'll all work out, or if it's true love, it'll be easy, or you shouldn't have to communicate, you'll just know what each other's thinking, or if it's meant to be, it will be, or if you're cute enough, you can change him, or if you're fit enough, she'll want you. I mean, these are storybook ending myths that we buy into far too often. And here's the thing. Some myths are innocent and silly, like the myth that Erie, PA has four seasons. It only has two, winter and the 4th of July, okay? There's the myth that one year all the potholes will be patched. It's never going to happen, okay? Those are harmless myths. But there's a whole other category of myths that aren't harmless. And if we follow them, they end up having serious consequences, especially when they're applied to marriage. Now, over time, life has a way of stripping myths away. But perhaps marriage is one of those areas where myths die hardest. Rather than embrace reality, we avoid it, preferring the comfort of the myth, even though it may ultimately work to destroy our marriages. And I think what all of us need to understand is that while reality can be painful, it's more like a sudden shaft of light in a darkened room. It may hurt your eyes at first, but it's ultimately what will show you the way. It's only in reality that we can have relationships that have a chance to move toward the kind of connectedness and joy and intimacy that God designed for marriage. And so we're going to bust some myths about marriage this month, and we're going to look into God's word to do it. Now, I need to correct one misconception before we begin. There are some who would say, well, why look at the Bible or look to Christianity about marriage? I mean, the statistics show that they're not doing it any better than anyone else. In fact, some studies are reporting that the divorce rate is actually higher among Christians than the general population. Let me correct some misleading information. Recent research shows that couples who are active in their faith, not just nominal Christians, are actually much less likely to get a divorce. Practicing Catholic couples were 31% less likely to divorce. Active Protestant couples, 35% less likely. Jewish couples, 97% less likely. I mean, that's really impressive. Now, nominal Christians, those people who call themselves Christians but don't actively engage with their faith or in any church, they're actually 20% more likely than the general population to get divorced. Now, maybe there's a link between putting on a show in both their religious and relational lives, but this tends to throw the numbers off a bit. And I say this to instill some confidence in you that those who take their faith seriously, like hopefully us in this room, who are more likely to follow God's word and God's design for our marriage, we're actually more likely to have marriages that are going to work. God's way works. Now, a quick word to singles. I pray that you'll continue to come and learn about this subject, because this isn't just about marriages, it's about the God of all people. And I want to remind you that marriage is not better than singleness. The goal of both marriage and singleness is Christ-likeness. And I believe that you're going to gain new insights into the heart of our God by attending and paying attention to this series. Now, there's another group of you for whom this subject is going to be incredibly painful, because you're going to focus this whole time on something that happened to you back in your past. And if you listen to me only through that lens, you'll hear every word I say from now on as judging you for what happened back there. But I'm talking about today, about your present and your future. And so I'd love for you to take the posture that says, from this day forward, don't be defensive and think that this message is about your mistakes. Focus on moving ahead. Okay, on to myth number one of our series. It's a bit mathematical in nature. If Pastor John was preaching this message, I'm sure he'd have trouble doing it. As a former math teacher, he would really struggle with the fuzzy math here. But for most of us, this was the very first math that we ever learned as little kids. It's 1 + 1 = 2. 1 raisin + 1 raisin = 2 raisins. 1 Barbie doll + 1 Barbie doll = 2 Barbie dolls, right? But God's math is different when it comes to marriage. He says that 1 + 1 doesn't = 2, it equals 1. 1 husband + 1 wife = 1 united supernatural entity in the eyes of God. This is actually the same math that God uses in the Trinity. 1 Father + 1 Son + 1 Spirit = 1 God. 1 + 1 = 1. Husband and wives are not called to be two independent individuals that live under the same roof. They're called to be one. Some of you have felt this kind of oneness with your spouse, where you're in sync. You're complementing each other. He's the yin to your yang. Every day you're falling deeper in love. But some of you are like, you know, it always doesn't work out like that. I mean, how do people go from being so passionate about one another that they call their friends and their family together to watch them merge their lives into one in a glorious occasion on a Saturday afternoon? How do they go from that to only speaking through attorneys? How do people go from racking up astronomical phone bills from using all your minutes to just sit there and listen to the other person breathe? You remember that? To not even be able to sit in the same room to divide up their assets together. What happened? But here's what happened. They stopped walking in the oneness that God offers us. So let's look at our text today and get into what oneness entails. Let's look at 3 verses in Ephesians 5, starting in verses 31 through 33. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. So these 3 verses are going to give us insight today into 3 ways to walk in oneness. The first is this. It's to become one in prioritizing each other. Both Paul here in Ephesians and Jesus in Matthew 19 from last week, they quoted from the creation account in Genesis 2:24, which says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united or cleave to his wife, and they will become one flesh." Now, Jesus adds to the language in Matthew 19, "so that they are no longer two, but one." And he says, "Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. Two become one." Your spouse becomes your new top priority. Now, there are 2 parts to this reprioritization. The first is leaving your parents. Up until this point, the most important relationship in your life was between you and your parents. But in marriage, the Bible says to leave your father and mother. Now, this doesn't mean abandon them. In fact, you're commanded to honor them for the rest of their lives. It simply means that your spouse becomes your new top priority, your top pursuit next to God. Your relationship with your parents now becomes secondary. It's like the story of the newlyweds who had been married for about a month, and the young wife had been pretty attached to her parents growing up. And the couple, they had their first big fight. And so the wife calls her mom on the phone crying, and she's saying, "He's such a jerk. I can't believe I married him. I can't stand him." And through tears, she finally says to her mom, "Mom, I want to come home." And after a pause, her mother very wisely responds, "Honey, you are home." There are little ways that you leave. You discuss decisions with your spouse first and your parents second. You determine your own holiday schedules and traditions, etc. But because if you don't properly leave your family of origin, things can create problems in your marriage. I mean, one of the great challenges in marriage is that you were simply raised differently. And if you're not careful, even little things from your 2 different upbringings can start to come against the unity of your marriage. I remember Kim and I were on our honeymoon. We drove from Erie to Hilton Head, right down the East Coast there. And we were young and in love, and we got so caught up in the conversation in the car that I looked up at one point and saw a sign that said, "Welcome to Kentucky." Now, that wasn't good. But we weathered it. You know, more time frolicking in the beautiful conversation with my new wife in the car. The trouble didn't come until we did our first load of laundry together in the little condo in Hilton Head. I was watching her fold my shirts while sitting on my hands and biting my tongue with every anal retentive alarm going off in my body. And finally, I said, "Are you going to leave them like that?" Now, this was not wise. Then I took the stack of clothes and I refolded them all. This was also not wise. This is silly when it's about differences in doing laundry or a disagreement about the proper position of the toilet seat. But what about when it's not laundry, but it's communication or how you do conflict or how you discipline your kids? Now all of a sudden, these differences from your upbringing can cause major problems. And so you have to leave your family of origin. But there's a second part to this reprioritization. You have to then cleave or be united to your spouse. This word cleave, it doesn't mean cleaver like a meat cleaver that chops off things. Some of you are like, yeah, that pretty much describes marriage to me. No. That's not what it means. It literally means to pursue with great energy or to cling to something zealously. And so does that describe your relationship with your spouse? Are you pursuing him with great energy? Are you clinging to her with zeal? I mean, it's making your marriage your top priority. And so often other priorities creep in, jobs and kids and hobbies and other friends and successes and ambitions. And all of a sudden your marriage is like way down the list. But we must cleave. We must be united. Because when you get married, the me becomes we. You're not a me anymore. You say, "Oh man, I got married. I feel like I kind of lost myself." Well, yes, you did. That's the idea. Marriage flies in the face, you see, of our selfishness. You know, we're the most self-centered people in history, right? You may have seen this picture of a bunch of girlfriends attending a baseball game. Beautiful night out for a baseball game, right? And they're into themselves. We're obsessed with self. Our grandparents, they understood that when you get married, you no longer get to use the first person pronoun to talk about life decisions. All the M's get flipped upside down. All the me's become we's. And you say, "Well, I'm going to get married, but I still want to have my own life too." Then don't get married. You're too selfish to have a spouse. Because when you get married, there are no more his and hers. Not when it comes to money, not when it comes to personal ambition, to hopes, to dreams, to struggles. Marriage means sharing everything. Guys, there's going to be stuff in your bathroom that you've never seen before. There's going to be stuff in there you can't even pronounce. It's a takeover. Because you're one flesh. The two have become one. The me has become we. And this applies especially to things like resolving conflict. So often we see conflict as adversarial, but what if we saw ourselves as unified even in our conflict? We're going to break away for a second so that you can see an object lesson about unity in the midst of conflict.
Hey guys, I'm here with my friends Dave and Danielle. They're going to help me walk through a little illustration about conflict with you. They're married, and so like many of us, we all have conflicts in marriage, whether that be how to parent our kids, it might be about finances, those things that come up. Think of whatever conflict normally comes up in your relationship, and then I'm going to represent that conflict for you today. And so when you have that conflict, when it comes up, it's usually between you. And so I'm going to ask you guys to grab this rope, and they're going to pull on it as if they're having a conflict and they're trying to resolve it, they're trying to move it. And this is what happens when the conflict is between them. Go ahead, guys. Try to move that conflict. And so you can see they're not having a whole lot of success. They're kind of making it uncomfortable for me as they squeeze the rope, but it's not having a lot of effect of moving the conflict, resolving that conflict. And so what if you change your perspective? Dave, I'm going to ask you to move over to this side where Danielle is. And so now, instead of being on opposite sides, instead of being on opposite teams, as it were, and being in conflict, they're on the same side. The conflict's still there. The conflict still needs to do hard work to resolve it. But now they have the perspective of being unified together. Guys, would you try to move that conflict now? Okay. So it's a lot easier in those situations when you have that perspective of being together and unified in Christ.
You see, when you're unified, your disagreements, they don't have a winner and a loser, because you either win together or you lose together every time. In oneness, our spouse must become our top priority. priority. This means that we're diligent about our time together. This means in our communication, in our decision making, in our problem solving, that our top priority is unity. Now let's look at verse 32. He says, this is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. Now, some of you can relate to Paul's wording here to describe your marriage. Sometimes you lay in bed after a long, hard day of trying to understand your spouse, and you can only sigh and say, this is a profound mystery, right? Isn't it true that at times your marriage seems like an unsolvable puzzle, a maze in which you feel a little lost? Well, Paul gives us a second clue into what it looks like to walk in oneness, becoming one in exalting Christ. Now, a lot of folks wonder about this. Why does Paul jump from talking about husbands and wives to Jesus and the church? Well, what's going on here? Well, Paul says that this is a mystery, but the word can also mean a secret. It's like he's pulling us aside and he's saying, hey, come here, come here. There's the secret to marriage, and some people don't know about it. And then he tells us the secret. He says, marriage is simply a shadow of a greater reality. You know, when you see a shadow, that shadow isn't the actual thing, but it points to something that actually exists. And marriage is a living parable that points us to what's going on between God and humanity in history. We're part of this great love story, you see. And so in Christian marriage, understanding this reality is actually a unifying factor for us. Paul says, do for your spouse what God did for you in Jesus, and the rest will follow. This is the secret. That the gospel of Jesus Christ and marriage, they explain each other. And so Jesus set aside his rights and his power and his status for the good of the other. And then in response to this incredible love, believers are changed and challenged to live flourishing lives. And so marriage becomes symbolic of this relationship. Tim Keller says it this way. The reason that marriage is so painful and yet wonderful is because it's a reflection of the gospel, which is also painful and wonderful all at once. The gospel is this: we are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared believe, and yet at the very same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared hope. This is the only kind of relationship that will really transform us, he says. Now think about it. With Christ at the center of our relationship, marriage is the major way that God uses the gospel to remake our hearts from the inside out. God will use your spouse to change you into Christ's likeness if you'll let him. Here's how it goes down in real life. Maybe your whole life you were a fearful person with a tendency toward anxiety. Or maybe you're a proud and opinionated and selfish person. Or perhaps you're incredibly inflexible and demanding. Or maybe you're undisciplined. Your time management stinks. You're unreliable and disorganized. And there are 100 other things that you may be. But here's the deal. Throughout your whole life you've been this way. And others have seen these flaws. Your parents saw them, your friends saw them, maybe pointed them out from time to time, or even joked about them. And you could always just write them off, because for those people, your flaws only created mild problems. Here's the beauty of marriage and the horror. For your spouse, in this close and committed and Christ-reflecting lifelong relationship, those flaws, they create major problems. Now remember, marriage doesn't create your defects, it simply reveals them, though you will try to blame your spouse for them all the time. And so if you've been hiding some flaw in the dark for many years, marriage will shine a light on it. And even though it hurts, we should be thankful, because we're a living picture of the gospel, remember. That is, a revealing of who we truly are, with all the scars and warts and imperfections, and with Christ's help, covered by unconditional love and grace. You see, when God is at the center, he moves us down a series of continuums. He moves us from self-centeredness toward being more servant-oriented. He moves us from judgmentalism toward being more accepting. He moves us from a retaliatory attitude toward a more forgiving spirit. He moves us from being defensive toward being more willing to admit our faults. When God is not at the center, this kind of growth is far less likely to happen. I think about myself. I mean, if I were the same person I used to be, I'm not sure Kim and I would still be together. And the same goes for her. I mean, early in our marriage, I used to prioritize my ministry. I mean, many weeks I was gone 4 and 5 nights out of the week. Now I'm gone 1 or 2 at the very most. Kim, she so selflessly put her career on hold when I became lead pastor. Why? Because God has been shaping our hearts along the way. I don't want to pretend we're further along than we are, but But to paraphrase Martin Luther King Jr., I may not be the man that I should be. I may not be the man that I someday will be, but thank God I'm not the man that I used to be. You see, we're not just two scrubs who got hitched and we're trying to make it day to day through life. No, no, no. Your marriage is a living parable for this whole dark world to see of what a relationship looks like between Jesus and his church. And this is a secret to our unity, Paul says. He's reminding us that if we will remember who we are representing, if we'll remember who's at the center of it all, whose reputation is on the line, maybe we will take the unity in our marriage a little more seriously. Some of you, you started out with a marriage that revealed Christ to the world. But over the years, you've drifted away from a Christ-centered marriage. Attending church together, it happens only when it's convenient now. You're too busy to find a life group. Substantial conversations about the important stuff of life have faded. Prayer and devotional reading are non-existent. Other things like following your kids' schedules, watching TV, checking your phones while you're in the same room together may be at the center of your relationship, but Jesus certainly isn't there. So how should a husband and a wife grow together spiritually to exalt Christ? Because remember, growing closer to God is the goal. Maybe you've seen this illustration, but as long as the two of you are moving closer to God up this triangle, you'll actually be moving closer to one another as well. The further you move up that triangle together, the closer you'll become to each other as well as to God. Let me offer this piece of advice on exalting Christ in your marriage. Would you figure out and understand how your spouse connects to God and then support them in that? Talk about it. If you don't necessarily need to be doing in-depth Bible studies together, although that's great if you do it, but start by having a conversation about how you each grow spiritually and then check in on how that's going from time to time and support each other in that. If it's helpful for your wife to read the Bible together, by all means do it. If she's at her spiritual best having some alone time in the morning with God, then help to create the atmosphere where she can have that time. Tell each other how you're doing and what you're doing in an atmosphere of support and respect, and you're going to be way ahead of the curve. Ask one another the question, how do you best connect with God? And then help each other make it happen. But if you're not exalting Christ in your marriage, you're not going to experience this unity and oneness that Paul's talking about. And so these three ways that we're talking to walk in oneness. The first is to become one in prioritizing each other. The second is to become one in exalting Christ. And the third is to become one in sacrifice. Paul says in verse 33, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. I love this because before there were books on the five love languages and his needs, her needs, the Bible had it right all along. The number one need of wives typically is the accepting and unequivocal love of their husbands, and the number one need of most husbands is the unwavering and devoted respect of their wives. And of course, we need the other stuff too, but I'm so impressed at how the Bible, so many generations ago, before psychological studies and studies of emotional needs and such, it nailed the top two emotional needs in a marriage for wives and husbands, love and respect. Now, here's the problem. Neither of us deserves it. Guys, she's going to be insane sometimes, like a combination of Gilbert Gottfried and Sam Kinison. And you're like, you mean I have to love her? Yes. And ladies, every night of your marriage, before he takes a shower, he's going to kick his underwear up off his foot and try to catch them. And he'll probably try to get you to watch and cheer for him when he succeeds, okay? And you're thinking, you're telling me I have to respect him? Yes. Yes. Earlier in the passage, Paul expounds on what the love looks like, guys. He says up in verse 25, husbands, love your wives. Now, we read that through 21st century eyes. We're very romantic, and we think emotional love, and so Paul needs to bring some clarity. What does it mean to love? He doesn't define it mostly as a feeling. He says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church, and listen, and gave himself up for her. Love is an emotion, it's action. And Paul is saying, now husbands, instead of treating marriage as an arrangement that's designed to provide you with perks and make you happy, you do for your bride what Jesus did for his bride when he sacrificially gave himself up. And if there's no sacrifice, there's no true love. If you can't point to things, guys, that you don't do anymore, personal desires that you're not chasing because of your love for her, then you don't have the kind of love for her that the Bible's asking about. It's sacrificial. We're going to have miserable marriages if we decide that we're going to only love our spouse when we feel like it. It's work. And sometimes, guys, love looks like serving her. It looks like getting your butt off the couch from watching ESPN and doing the dishes and helping with the laundry and helping kids with their homework and getting the kids ready for their day. Sometimes love looks like spoiling her, spending too much on a dinner or a gift that would make her happy. Sometimes love looks like freeing her, making arrangements for her to be by herself for a while with a good book and a glass of wine in a hotel room without you in it waiting for a payoff. But to be Christ-like love, it will always involve sacrifice. And wives, respecting your husbands also involves sacrifice. I've heard so many wives say, well, he hasn't earned my respect. Notice the Bible doesn't say anything here about him earning it. Just like it didn't say anything about you earning his love. This is sacrificial respect. You say, well, how can I respect someone that I don't respect? We do it all the time. In retail, we do it with customers. You treat customers with respect, even if they annoy you. We do it in courtrooms, even if the judge is personally a jerk, that we respect him. And so there are places where we give respect, even if it wasn't earned. Wives, don't make your husband earn it. Treat him like he already has it. In general, husbands crave respect in ways that you probably don't understand. Men typically don't respond to belittling, they don't respond to shaming or drive-by guiltings and other methods like that. They respond to respect. How much do men crave respect? Do you know what most men do when they don't feel loved? They shrug their shoulders. Do you know what they do when they don't feel respected, when they feel disrespected? They go to battle. You ever watch sports? There's this thing called bulletin board material, which means that the other team made some comments in the media that shows disrespect to my team. And so I take that article and I put it up on the bulletin board and a whole team will rise to the occasion. Why? Because they were disrespected. You'll be amazed at the impact that you can have on your marriage, women, if in those moments when he deserves it the least, if you will sacrificially respect him. Speak to him with respect. Speak about him respectfully to other people while he's listening. Speak respectfully about him when he's not even around. Show him that you're proud of what he's doing. Communicate appreciation for the work that he does. You will be amazed. He'll probably start cleaning the house all on his own. One of the most important things that will unify our marriages is to be unified and one in sacrifice, love, and respect. And do you know why these two things have so much power in a marriage? It's because that love and respect is coming from someone who knows you better than anyone else. If one of you guys were to come up to me after this message today and say, hey man, that sermon was great. I respect you so much. That would be really nice. It would mean a lot to me. But the whole time in the back of my mind, I could be thinking, yeah, but you don't really know me. I mean, if you knew this one thing about me, you probably wouldn't respect me as much. But if my wife says after 24 years of marriage, you know what, babe? I respect you so much, and here's why. Whew. That's a powerful force. Guys, there's nothing more powerful to look at. That woman who you know inside and out, you know the flaws, you know the blemishes, you know the idiosyncrasies, and to say to her, I love you, babe, and here are all the reasons why. You see, when we're fully known and fully loved, when we're fully known and fully respected, our lives are going to begin to get knit together at the very core of who we are. But it takes sacrifice. I want to challenge you to take a step in your marriage today. Pick one of these three steps to oneness, either prioritizing each other, exalting God in your marriage, or sacrificially loving or respecting one another. Pick one of those three things and take one step toward oneness today. Remember, 1 + 1 = 1. We just need to walk out that truth. We have a great opportunity happening every Wednesday night this month at 6:30 at all our locations for couples to come together and to have some further discussion about these matters. It's a marriage mythbusters discussion group. Some of our marriage ministry team will be facilitating that time. It'll be very, very useful to you. But I also realize that there are some of you listening for whom this message has been very painful. Maybe you're on the brink of divorce. Maybe you're in one place spiritually and your spouse is at another. Maybe you've just lost hope. You're just existing together, surviving, not thriving. It feels like your marriage is broken. Can I give you two words of coaching? The first is this: be careful who you're getting marriage advice from. You may have friends giving you advice who love you dearly, but they don't know Jesus and they don't give wise counsel. Plenty of people are going to give you counsel that will go against the scriptures. You'll have buddies say, hey, ditch her, dump her, man, she's worthless. You know, you'll be great, you'll be free. And ladies, you'll have girlfriends who'll say, you deserve better than that guy. Just get rid of him. Be careful who you listen to. The second thing I'd say is to get help. Reach out to our team. Get help at whoisgrace.com. Request a marriage mentor. You saw earlier what it did for Mike and Nikki. But reach out now before it's too late. I love you guys, and I pray that God would use these next 3 weeks to bring health and healing to many marriages. Remember, 1 + 1 = 1. We're called to live in the unity that God has already given us. Bless you.